topic of today's seminar is Aquinas the Aristotelian. Instead of studying Aquinas' reception of Aristotle across the sprawling oeuvre of the angelic doctor, which would take us numerous semesters to do, I have chosen a more manageable project for our seminar. We will focus on one of Aquinas' relatively rare polemical writings, a work in which, on strictly philosophical grounds, he reads, defends, and develops Aristotle's philosophy over against some contemporary opponents, the Latin Averroists. Thomas wrote on the unicity of the intellect against the Averroists during his second regency, his second stay, tenure, on the Dominican chair in theology at the University of Paris in the year 1270, 4 years before his death. Aquinas' deepest convictions about the value of Aristotle for understanding human nature and destiny come into play in this polemical opusculum. In it, he takes issue with the teaching on the soul advanced in the Latin translation of the Andalusian philosopher Ibn Rushd in his great commentary on Aristotle's treatise on the soul. Ibn Rushd, Latinized Averroes, was born in 1126 in Cordoba, in the then Almoravid Caliphate, and died in 1198 in Marrakesh, in the then Almohad Caliphate. He came from a prominent family of judges, and he himself served as judge and also as court physician. Averroes wrote works on philosophy, theology, medicine, astronomy, physics, and Islamic jurisprudence and law. He was a strong proponent of what he took to be an authentic Aristotelianism. He attempted to restore what he considered the original teachings of Aristotle and opposed the Neoplatonist tendencies of earlier Muslim thinkers, such as Al-Farabi and Avicenna. He also defended the pursuit of philosophy against criticism by theologians, such as Al-Ghazali. Averroes argued that philosophy was permissible in Islam, a highly contested issue, and even compulsory among certain elites. In order to harmonize his Aristotelianism with the teachings of Mohammed, Averroes maintained the existence of many in principle incompatible truths, separated by impervious partitions, and indeed separated into three superimposed orders by which the Quran is to be interpreted. First, for the people, to whom the material is presented simply by oratory, and say in form of catechesis. Second, for the theologian, who looks for a mystical interpretation of the Quran and uses probable reasoning for that. And third, for the philosopher, who operates by way of scientific, that means syllogistic, demonstration. If there be conflict between the text of the Quran and the proofs, the latter prevail, and the text is to be interpreted allegorically. These three superimposed orders of truth are not always harmonizable. Each type of mind, the rustic, the theologian, and the philosopher, should be content with a meaning that is proportioned to each one of them, and that is true for their respective talent. So far, Averroes. In the West, Averroes was known primarily for his extensive commentaries on Aristotle, many of which were translated into Latin and also into Hebrew. The translations of his work reawakened in Western Europe interests in Aristotle, works that at that time had not been available until then or considered, primarily the metaphysics, the physics, and on the soul. Now it is crucial to register at this point already that Thomas contests the views that Averroes advances in his great commentary as Thomas and his opponents knew it in Latin. Neither Thomas nor his opponents were able to read Averroes in the original Arabic, and hence were unable to compare the Latin translation of his commentary with the original. Averroes in Latin was the father of what should be called Latin Averroism, an intellectual current emerging in the liberal arts faculty, and that's important, in the liberal arts faculty at the University of Paris. The great commentary had been translated into Latin in Paris in 1225. Beginning in 1250, 25 years after its translation, beginning in 1250 with Albert the Great, theologians at Paris, in the School of Theology, in the Faculty of Theology, started to criticize Averroes for monopsychism, the teaching that all humans share the same eternal consciousness, soul, and intellect, conceived of as one or several separate substances in which all human beings participate. It seems to be pretty clear from the Latin translation, at least, of the great commentary, that Averroes taught that both possible and agent intellects, I will explain what those terms mean later, were separate substances and not powers of the individual human soul. Other masters of theology followed suit after Albert the Great. Robert Kilverby, Bonaventure, and Thomas Aquinas continued this critique. Now, Latin Averroism begins precisely at that point when masters in the faculty of arts, philosophers in the strict sense as we would call them now, accept and defend Averroes as he is interpreted and criticized by the masters of theology. The most prominent, should I say notorious, among the Latin Averroists is Seeger of Brabant, 1240 to 1280. By the end of 1270, three things pertinent to our topic had happened. First, sometime between 1269 and 1270, Seeger of Brabant commented on Book 3 of Aristotle's On the Soul, a notoriously difficult book, in the liberal arts faculty of the University of Paris. Here's the gist of his teaching as it reached Thomas by way of lecture notes and oral reports from students who were sitting in Seeger's lectures. Seeger of Brabant defends the unity of the intellect, that is, the indivisible oneness of the intellect. He understands this to be Aristotle's position in On the Soul. Seeger argues that insofar as intellection, a purely spiritual action, not involving the body, is accomplished without any physical organ, the intellectual soul cannot be the form of the body. It is only matter that gives numerical multiplication. The soul is necessarily singular, one for all humans, and is to be identified with the last celestial sphere closest to the earth, the moon. Human beings are nevertheless multiple and numerically distinct through the sensible portion of their being. Since the law of the intellect is to know through abstraction, that is, by uniting with a sensible phantasm, one can explain the multiple variety of human acts of intellection. Only in this sense can intellection be attributed to an individual human being. The human being furnishes the material for the operation of abstraction that occurs within her or him. This point will be important for Thomas's counter-argument. According to Seeger, the human furnishes the material for an operation of abstraction that occurs within him or her, but is not his or hers, according to Seeger. A conception of this sort, of course, destroys personal immortality. Only the human race concentrated in this unique intellect is immortal and eternal, as is the universe, according to Seeger. Since it is immaterial, the human race thus avoids all the vicissitudes incumbent on material substances. According to Seeger, the human race is unbegotten and incorruptible. It has necessarily existed from all time and is at the same time always substantially separated and always united for action to the successive generations of humans here on Earth. So much for the inferences Seeger drew from Aristotle's teaching in On the Soul in his lectures given at the Liberal Arts Faculty at the University of Paris somewhere between 1269 and 1270. Sometime after that, those lectures, but pretty close to the end of them, and before, prior to December 10, 1270, and I will in a minute say why we know that, and prior to December 10, 1270, Thomas writes his opusculum in response to Seeger's teaching. What happened on December 10? On December 10, 1270, the Bishop of Paris, Etienne Tempier, intervenes. He condemns 13 propositions. Those knowingly holding these propositions were excommunicated. Here are the 13 condemned positions. They are of quite interest for us. First, and remember they are the condemned positions. First, that there is numerically one and the same intellect for all human beings. Condemned. Second, that this is false or improper. Humans understand. Condemned. Third, that a human being's will necessarily wills or chooses. Condemned. Four, that all things here below come under the necessary control of the heavenly bodies. Condemned. Fifth, that the world is eternal. Condemned. Sixth, that there never was a first human. Condemned. Seven, that the soul, which is the form of the human being, insofar as the human being is human, corrupts when the body corrupts. Condemned. Eight, that the soul separated by death cannot suffer from bodily fire. Condemned. Nine, that free will is a passive, not an active power, and that it is moved necessarily by the desired object. Condemned. 10. That God does not know singulars. Condemned. 11. That God does not know things other than himself. Condemned. 12. That human acts are not ruled by the providence of God. Condemned. 13. That God cannot grant immortality or incorruption to a mortal and corruptible thing. Condemned. So far, the condemnations by Bishop Tempier from December 10, 1270. Now back to Thomas's work. We know that he wrote it before December 10 because there is no reference and no awareness of the fact of the condemnation of these 13 theses. He would have referred to them, he would have drawn upon them as authorities in a certain way had he written after that. We can assume that because in other works he does so. So he wrote it sometime before, but after the lectures were completed by Seeger of Brabant. In his opusculum, Thomas attacks the view that the possible intellect is an entity existing separately from the individual, and that the single separately existing intellect is common to all human beings, a position contemned subsequently by Bishop Tempier. At this point, a few words are necessary about the possible intellect and the agent intellect that I already talked about. You might recall, some of you who had maybe the opportunity to read Aristotle's On the Soul, that the discussion of the intellect arises in Aristotle's work out of the discussion of the faculties of the soul involved in sensing. Aristotle moves bottom up, so to speak, and that is very important for his account of the intellect in On the Soul. So, the senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And then Aristotle moves from there into the discussion of the very important internal senses, which are senses, though internal. They are common sense, imagination, the cogitative power, and the memorative sense. I can talk more about that if necessary, but I better skip over that. I have short characterizations of each one of them, but they might derail us a little bit. And then in the famous chapter 4 of book 3, after Aristotle unfolded the senses, Aristotle begins to compare the intellect with the senses, contrasts between them, and thereby differentiates the intellect from the senses, but at the same time develops the understanding of the intellect in analogy with the senses. The first characteristic of intellect arrived at by this comparison and contrast with sense is that, unlike sense, intellect is a capacity or faculty, not a nature. What does he mean? A sense cannot sense everything, but rather only things that fall within the range of its proper object. For sight, color, for hearing, sound, etc. But anything is the possible object of thought. Hence, the receptive intellect or possible intellect cannot have a nature, Aristotle argues. In order for the receptive or possible intellect to become anything, it must itself be no determinate nature. The determinate nature would actually hinder it becoming of assimilating an object and thereby understanding it. Therefore, unlike the senses, the receptive or possible intellect cannot be blended with body. It's Aristotle's further argument. It cannot be blended with body as the senses are. It is separate. That is, it does not have a bodily organ, the intellect. While the faculty of sensation is dependent upon the body, the possible intellect is separable from it and thus can potentially become anything by receiving that thing's intelligible form. The medievals will call it species. I will say a word about that in a minute. Consider the most condensed articulation of Aristotle's account in Thomas's own rendition, in his Compendium Theologiae, chapter 88. I highly recommend the compendium. He wrote that for one of his friends, one of his secretaries, Brother Reginald, who said the Summa is so complicated and so long, couldn't you write a summary? And Thomas was a very charitable man. He sat down and did it. He didn't finish it, though. There were too many other works pressing in on him. But what we have of the compendium is a remarkably condensed and clear digest of his own thought in the Summa Theologiae. And that is already a simplified version of other things he has done. In chapter 88, he has a very interesting and helpful summary of how he reads Aristotle on the possible and on the ancient intellect. I quote, "The possible intellect is in potency with regard to intelligible objects in the sense that it does not contain within its nature any determinate form of sensible things. In the same way, the pupil of the eye is in potency with regard to all colors. To the extent, then, that phantasms abstracted from sensible things are likenesses of definite sensible things, they are related to the possible intellect as act is to potency. Nevertheless, the phantasms are in potency with regard to something that the intellectual soul possesses in act, namely being, as abstracted from material conditions. And in this respect, the intellectual soul is related to the phantasms as act to potency. No contradiction is involved if a thing is in act and potency with regard to the same object according to different points of view. Thus, natural bodies act upon each other and are acted upon by each other, for each is in potency with respect to the other. The same intellectual soul, therefore, can be in potency with regard to all intelligible objects, and nevertheless, without any contradiction, can be related to them as act, if both a possible intellect and an agent intellect are acknowledged in the soul. This will be seen more clearly from the way the intellect renders objects actually intelligible. The agent intellect does not render objects actually intelligible in the sense that the latter flow from it into the possible intellect. If this were the case, this is important, if this were the case, we would have no need of phantasms and sense in order to understand. No, the agent intellect renders things actually intelligible by abstracting them from phantasms, which are received by the senses, by way of the senses. Just as light, in a certain sense, renders color actual, not as though it contained the colors within itself, but so far as it confers visibility on them. In the same way, we are to judge that there is a single intellectual soul that lacks the natures of sensible things, but can receive them in an intelligible manner, and that renders phantasms actually intelligible by abstracting intelligible species from them. The power whereby the soul is able to receive intelligible species is called the possible intellect, and the power whereby it abstracts intelligible species from phantasms is called the agent intellect. The latter, the agent intellect, is a sort of intelligible light communicated to the intellectual soul in imitation of what takes place among the higher intellectual substances. He's referring here to angels. Unquote. The great 20th century historian of medieval philosophy, Etienne Gilson, articulates well the difficulty modern interpreters of Thomas's metaphysics of knowledge face when confronted with a thing's intelligible form, its species. Gilson states in his classic, The Christian Philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, quote, practically speaking, it is almost impossible to speak of the species except as if the species were an image, an equivalent or substitute for the object. But it is important to understand that the species of an object is not one being and the object another. The species is rather the very object under the mode of species. That is, it is still the object considered in action and in the efficacy it exerts over a subject. Under this one condition only can we say that it is not the species of the object that is present in thought, but the object through its species. And as it is the form of the object which is its active and determining principle, so it is the form of the object which the intellect which knows it through its species becomes. The intellect becomes the form of the object by way of the species. The species is an instrument. So far, Gilson. The terms impressed species and expressed species distinguish the two moments of this identity. The impressed species is the modification of the intellect. The intellect becomes, so to speak, the object through the action of the object. The expressed species is the reaction of the active or agent intellect as a cognitive process. The active or agent intellect, which is no more actually than the dynamic quality of the intellect, permeates every instance of our knowledge analogously to the presence of light in every instance of perceived color, and is required to illuminate the possible intellect to make the potential knowledge into knowledge in act, in the same way that light makes potential colors into actual colors. The function of the agent intellect consists in abstracting the impressed species from the received phantasms and actuating it in such a way as to render it intelligible. then the agent intellect does so by producing the species expressa, that is, its conscious expression, the formulated concept, which is a prolongation, as it were, of the object. The agent intellect thus renders the object knowable. In this state, the possible intellect can receive the species and becomes knowledge in act, actual understanding. In sum, according to Thomas's interpretation of Aristotle's teaching in On the Soul, Book 3, the intellect has a twofold ability. First, to become the object, and second, to engender a concept while it is fecundated by the object. Importantly, the concept flows from two sources. It originates from the intellect through an act of the intellect, and it is the likeness of the thing understood. The object supplies the formal content, while the intellect bestows the act of spiritual or intentional being, esse intentionale. Nota bene. According to Aristotle and Aquinas, and I'm following them here both, the formal content of knowledge is not modified by the knower, as Kant would have it, and with him the so-called transcendental Thomists like Karl Rahner. Furthermore, the expressed species or concept is the first conscious presence of the object in the mind. No representation, therefore, separates the concept from the object that it expresses, as Locke would have it. As Gilson puts it lucidly, the whole objectivity of human knowledge depends in the last analysis upon the fact that the species is not a super-added intermediary or a distinct substitute which is introduced into our thought in place of the thing. It is rather the sensible species of the thing itself, which, rendered intelligible by the agent intellect, becomes the form of our possible intellect. Unquote. Gilson, the Christian philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. Now we are in a position to turn to Aquinas' Opusculum De Unitate Intellectus Contra Averroistes. The Latin Averroist position that the intellect is a substance that exists apart from the body is quite obviously in conflict with the Christian faith. Yet it is also, Thomas thinks, in fundamental conflict with the teaching of Aristotle as advanced in On the Soul. Thomas's project in De Unitate Intellectus is not to demonstrate that the Latin Averroist position is incompatible with the Christian faith. Rather, because the Latin Averroist position is held as a strictly philosophical position, Thomas's sole aim is to advance philosophical arguments that demonstrate that the position that the intellect is a substance that exists apart from the body is untenable. He goes about doing this in two ways. First, by an appeal to the philosophical authority of Aristotle, whom Thomas's opponents invoke. Thomas shows himself here as the superior reader and interpreter of Aristotle, and as a deeper and more nuanced Aristotelian than his Latin Averroist opponents. Second, based on Aristotle's considered positions, Thomas advances a range of philosophical arguments that demonstrate that the intellect is indeed the substantial form of the body, and that furthermore, the intellect is not one for all human beings. Thomas's small work comprises 5 chapters. We will focus especially on the first and the third chapter. The first chapter is by far the longest. Here Thomas offers a rather painstaking textual argument that Aristotle did not teach that the intellect is a substance existing separately from the body. Thomas's overall goal is to show that the position of his opponents cannot be reconciled with Aristotle's argument in his treatise on the soul. The second chapter is the shortest chapter of the work. In it, Thomas deprives his opponents of the support of other commentators of Aristotle. Neither Greek nor Arab commentators, Thomas argues, support the Averroists. After extensive textual argumentation, Thomas advances in the third chapter 3 philosophical arguments showing that the intellect is a power of the soul, which is the form of the body. This is philosophically the central chapter of Thomas's work. In the fourth chapter, Thomas returns to the Averroes position that the intellect in all human beings is one. This, Thomas argues in this chapter, leads to absurdities. Furthermore, it is incompatible with Aristotle's teaching. And moreover, none of the efforts to relate intellect to our phantasms make sense as an explanation of human knowledge. In the fifth and last chapter, Thomas defends the claim that there is a plurality of possible intellects, one for each person, against six Averroist objections to his own position. Thomas's argument against Sigar of Brabant unfolds fundamentally in three steps. The first step comprises the first two chapters. Here Thomas adopts the authority of Aristotle and justifies his interpretation on Aristotle's On the Soul by basing it on the definition of the soul they are given. The first, actuality of a physically organized body. The human operations are those of vegetation, sensation, comprehension, and self-movement. These four abilities are in the same subject, the soul, and the intellect is a power of the soul, not using a bodily organ. Sigar's counter-argument against this position would be that if the intellectual soul were the form of the body, the intellect would be nothing more than the faculty of a material composite, and would have to be a form joined to a bodily organ, which Aristotle denies. Thomas answers that by its position in the hierarchy of forms, the human soul partakes of the nature of spiritual and of corporeal beings in such a manner that it is at once both joined and separated according to its diverse faculties. In this way, he resolves the essential objection against his interpretation of Aristotle. So far, the first chapter. In the brief second chapter, Thomas refers to other authors and shows that he is in agreement with three other commentators of Aristotle's On the Soul, Al-Ghazil, Avicenna, and Themistius. The latter he knew through a recent translation made by William of Merbeke, which had been ignored by Sigar of Brabant. In the third and fourth chapter, which form the second step of Thomas's argument, he resolves the problem on its own merits, showing that only his view is demonstrable by reason. The fundamental proof is the argument taken from consciousness. In order that the testimony from experience this individual human being understands be really intelligible, it is necessary that each human being possesses his or her own intellect. Thomas adds other arguments based on the definition of the human being and on the nature of the human being's essential unity. Thomas also observes that the unity of the intellect involves the unity of the will in all human beings, a conclusion that would entail the destruction of independence and of personal responsibility, both of which are affirmed by consciousness. Finally, he argues that the existence of knowledge from principles, that is, science, exists in some individuals but not in others, and also the fact of contrasting errors in other people demands that each has his or her own intellect. In the fifth chapter, the third step of Thomas's argument against Sigar, Thomas finally answers the objections which Sigar would make and points out the odd position of a Catholic philosopher who would defend as demonstrable by reason propositions formally opposed to the teaching of the faith. Such a person is logically forced to hold the existence of two realms of truth, the one natural, the other supernatural, and that these truths could be contradictory. Incidentally, as briefly discussed earlier, this theory was defended by Averroes, who held to the existence of three independent realms of truth. Yet Thomas takes such a view to be absurd, and one that indeed all Catholics reject. To conclude my introductory remarks, there are many things we can learn about Aquinas, the Aristotelian, from this brief work. First, about Aristotle. Second, about Aristotle's controversial reception in the Latin Middle Ages, first by way of the Arabs and then directly. And third, about Thomas as an interpreter of Aristotle, and as a theologian who appreciates not all, but most of Aristotle's insights as compatible with the Christian faith, and furthermore as granting intelligibility to central tenets of the Christian faith. Especially in questions of epistemology, Thomas follows Aristotle. Thomas prefers Aristotle to other philosophical alternatives because Aristotle offers an integrated account of sense perception and intellectual knowledge. This account accords with the specific nature of the human being as a rational animal and with the constitution of the human being as a holomorphic unity of body and soul. Furthermore, Aristotle's teaching affords a philosophical account of the intellectual soul as the substantial form of the body and simultaneously as existing by its own act of existence and therefore as incorruptible, non-decomposable through natural processes. If Thomas were a contemporary, he would say Aristotle's account of the soul in general and of the metaphysics of knowledge in particular saves the appearances best and furthermore grants rational intelligibility to central tenets of the Christian faith. In paragraph 38 of the text you have in front of you, Thomas formulates what is for him the essential philosophical insight that Aristotle advances in On the Soul about the human intellect, an insight that, according to Thomas, backs one of the most central tenets of the Christian faith, that the human soul is directly created by God and can therefore only be annihilated by God, but is, unlike plant souls and animal souls, incorruptible and in this sense immortal. It survives the separation of body and soul at death. Thomas states, quote, "The form, which has an operation according to some potency or power of its own, apart from being joined with its matter, is that which itself has being. Nor does it exist only through the being of the composite, like other forms, but rather the composite exists through its, the form's, being. And therefore, when the composite is destroyed, there is destroyed that form which exists through the being of the composite, whereas there is no need that upon the destruction of the composite there be destroyed that form through which being the composite exists, through whose being the composite exists, and which does not itself exist through the being of the composite." That is, of course, the intellectual soul. I'm adding a brief paragraph from section 104, where this comes out quite explicitly. Section 104 in the text. "Just as the being, esse, of the soul, is indeed in the body inasmuch as it is the form of the body, nor does it exist before the body, and yet after the body is destroyed, it still remains its being, esse. So each soul remains in its own unity, and consequently many souls in their manyness." Unquote. To summarize, what is the upshot of Thomas's reading of Aristotle's On the Soul in his opposition to the Latin Averroists? First, the rational soul is the substantial form of the human body. It gives that body its own nature, for it is the radical principle by which the human being lives, vegetatively, sensitively, and intellectively. These various vital acts, since they are not accidental to the human being but natural, must come from human nature, from the specific principle that animates the human body. Second, the rational soul alone does not make a human being to be a human. It is not the soul alone, but each human being is aware that she uses not only her mind but also her sense powers. But without body, there can be no sense activity. Hence, the body too belongs to the constitution of the human being. But can we not say with Averroes that the soul is an impersonal intelligence united with the body, say, of Martin Heidegger, in order to accomplish there that act which we call thinking, denken? No, again, because such a union, being accidental, not essential, would prevent the act of thinking from being in truth the action of Heidegger. Heidegger would have to say not I think, but instead it thinks, somewhat as we say it reigns. Nor can we say further that intelligence is united to the body as a motor, to move and guide the body, since thus it would follow that Heidegger would not be a natural unity, would not have one nature only. Third, the rational soul can be a spiritual thing, even if it is the principle of vegetative and sense life. Because, as Thomas states, quote, the higher a form is, the less it is immersed in matter, the more likewise does it dominate matter, and the higher does its operation rise above materiality, unquote. Even the animal soul is endowed with sense activity. Much more then can the rational soul, even as form of the body, dominate that body and still be endowed with intellectual knowledge. The spiritual soul communicates its own substantial existence to corporeal matter, and this existence is the one and only existence of the human composite. Hence, also, the human soul, in contrast to the soul of animals, preserves its own existence after the destruction of the body that it vivified. I thank you for your attention.